Hello, people, once again. I'm here for what is, I don't know, maybe sadly to some because they thought they might be listening to the whole of Human Action throughout this. The last part of the Human Action Telethon, as it has been aptly named. This is all, for those who aren't aware yet so far, this has all been a effort to fundraise so I can make it to the Mises Institute and take advantage of the scholarship they've given me for a week in July this year. As Scrump rather affectionately called it last night, this is basically my chance to go to my version of Disneyland. So if anyone wants to help me in that and push forward the GoFundMe towards its goal, throughout this either last stream, I think I'll probably leave the fund up for another week or so whilst things still kind of sift through. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I suppose I've been very thankful to all the people that have helped me over the last sort of 10 days or so by donating to the fund or sharing it about, because I would argue both are just as important as one another. And I don't know. I didn't really think I have much else to say. I might as well just crack on and continue, really. I wonder if people will show up and chat or not. Oh, wait. Tell you what. I'll let people show up and chat for a minute or two because I don't have a random placeholder image. No, I do actually. Let me sort that. Stick that on quickly. I'll be back in just about a second. Right. Right, OBS, right. Oh. I've opened the bloody Audacity thing. Whoops. Go away. Right. Number three, the changeability of prices. Exchange ratios are subject to perpetual change because the conditions which produce them are perpetually changing. The value that an individual attaches both to money and to various goods and services is the outcome of a moment's choice. Every later instant may generate something new and bring about other considerations and valuations. Not that prices are fluctuating, but that they do not alter more quickly could be deemed, or could be fairly be deemed, a problem requiring explanation. Daily experience teaches people that the exchange ratios of the market are mutable. One would assume that their ideas about prices would take full account of this fact. Nevertheless, all popular notions of production and consumption, marketing and prices are more or less contaminated by a vague and contradictory notion of price rigidity. The layman is prone to consider this the preservation of yesterday's price structure both as normal and as fair, and to condemn changes in the exchange ratios as a violation of the rules of nature and of justice. It would be a mistake to explain these popular beliefs as a precipitate of old opinions conceived in earlier ages of more stable conditions of production and marketing. It is questionable whether or not prices were changeable in those older days. On the contrary, it could rather be asserted that the merger of local markets into larger national markets, the final emergence of a world embracing world market, and the evolutions of commerce attaining at continuously supplying the consumers have made price changes less frequent and less sharp. In pre-capitalistic times, there was more stability in technological methods of production, but there was much more irregularity in supplying the various local markets and adjusting supply to their changing demands. But even if it were true that prices were somewhat more stable in a remote past, it would be of little avail for our age. The popular notions about money and money prices are derived from ideas formed in the past. It would be wrong to interpret them as atavistic remnants. Under modern conditions, every individual is daily faced with so many problems of buying and selling that we are right in assuming that his thinking about these matters is not simply a thoughtless reception of traditional ideas. I need to quickly copy the link. Yeah, there will be a link both in the description. God, that's not done that right. Give me a second here. Give me the shorthand link, please. There we go. Yeah, there is both a pinned link in the chat and a link in the description for the fund that I had mentioned earlier. Anyone wants to help or share that around? It is easy to understand why those short-run interests are hurt by a change in prices, resent but also more normal and maintain that price stability. Sorry, have I just completely skipped a line there? I have. It is easy to understand why those whose short-run interests are hurt by a change in prices resent such changes. Emphasize that the previous prices were not only fairer but also more normal, and maintain that price stability is in conformity with the laws of nature and morality, and of morality. But every change in prices furthers the short-run interests of other people. Those favoured will certainly not be promoted by the urge to stress the fairness and normalcy of price rigidity. Neither atavistic remnants nor the state of selfish group interests can explain the popularity of the idea of price stability. Its roots are to be seen in the fact that notions concerning social relations have been constructed according to the pattern of the natural sciences. The economists and sociologists who aimed at shaping the social sciences according to the pattern of physics or physiology only indulged in a way of thinking which popular fallacies had adopted long before. Even the classical economists were slow to free themselves from this error. With them, value was something objective, i.e., a phenomenon of the external world and a quality inherent in things and therefore measurable. God, my voice is going already, that's not good. They utterly failed to comprehend the purely human and voluntaristic character of value judgments. As far as we can see today, it was Samuel Bailey who first disclosed what is going on in preferring one thing to another, but his book was overlooked as were the writings of other precursors of the subjective theory of value. It is not only a task of economic science to discard the errors concerning measurability in the field of action, it is no less a task of economic policy for the failures of present-day economic policies. Are to some extent due to the lamentable confusion brought about by the idea that there is something fixed and therefore measurable in interhuman relations. Well, sorry about that. Number 4, stabilization. An outgrowth of all these errors is the idea of stabilization. Shortcomings in the government's handling of monetary matters and the disastrous consequences of policies aimed at lowering the rate of interest and at encouraging business activities through credit expansion give birth to the ideas which finally generated the slogan stabilization. I just finished the whole 57 hours of the MES audiobook. God, that's a 57-hour audiobook. That's going to take me so long to read that big version of it. I've got it sitting downstairs. Needs to be done, though, I suppose. One can explain its emergence and its popular appeal. One can understand it as the fruit of the last 150 years of currency and banking. One can, as it were, plead extenuating circumstances for the errors involved. But no such sympathetic appreciation can render its fallacies any more tenable. Stability, the establishment of which the programme of stabilisation aims at, is an empty and contradictory notion. The urge towards action, i.e., improvement of the conditions of life, is inborn in man. Man himself changes from moment to moment, and his valuations, volitions, and acts change with him. In the realm of action, there is nothing perpetual but change. There is no fixed point in a ceaseless fluctuation other than the eternal a prioristic categories of action. It is vain to sever valuation and action from man's unsteadiness and the changeability of his conduct and to argue as if there were in the universe Eternal values independent of human value judgments and suitable to serve as yardsticks for the appraisal of real action. All methods suggested for a measurement of the changes in the monetary unit's purchasing power are more or less unwittingly founded on the illusory image of an eternal and immutable being who determines by the application of an immutable standard the quantity of satisfaction which a unit of money conveys to him. It is a poor justification of this ill-thought idea that what is wanted is merely to measure changes in purchasing power of money. The crux of the stability notion lies precisely in this concept of purchasing power. The layman, labouring under the idea of physics, once considered money as a yardstick of prices. He believed that fluctuations of exchange ratios occur in the relations between the various commodities and services, and not also in the relation between money and the totality of goods and services. Later, people reversed the argument. It was no longer money to which constancy of value was attributed, but the totality of things vendable and purchasable. People began to devise methods for working up complexes of commodity units to be contrasted to the monetary unit. Eagerness to find indexes for the measurement of purchasing power silenced all scruples. But the doubtfulness and the incomparability of the price records employed and the arbitrary character of the producers used for the computation of averages were disregarded. Irving Fisher, the eminent economist who was the champion of the American stabilization movement, contrasts with the dollar a basket containing all the goods the housewife buys in the market for the current provision of her household. I must have a wee bit of water in my ear or something. There's a horrible echo going on inside my own head. But I shan't moan. This would be alright if the housewife and her imaginary basket were constant elements, if the basket were always to contain the same goods and the same quantity of each, and if the role which this assortment of goods plays in the family's life were not to change, but we are living in a world in which none of these conditions is realised. First of all, is the fact that the quality of the commodities produced and consumed changes continuously. It is a mistake, to identify wheat with wheat, not to speak of shoes, hats, and other manufacturers. The great price differences in these synchronous sales of commodities which mundane speech and statistics arrange in the same class clearly evidences this truism. An idiomatic expression asserts that two peas are alike, but buyers and sellers distinguish various qualities and grades of peas. A comparison of prices paid at different places or at different dates for commodities which technology or statistics call by the same name is useless if it is not certain that their qualities, but for the place difference, are perfectly the same. Quality means, in this connection, all those properties to which the buyers and the would-be buyers pay heed. The mere fact that the quality of all goods and services of the first order is subject to change explodes one of the fundamental assumptions of all index number methods. Oh, give me a second here. Sorry about that, I seem to have some sort of either bubble of air or fluid or something trapped in one of my ears. It's horrible. The mere fact that the quality of all goods and services of the first order is subject to change explodes one of the fundamental assumptions of all index number methods. It is irrelevant that a limited amount of goods of the higher orders, especially metals and chemicals, which can be uniquely determined by a formula, are liable to a precise description of their characteristic features. A measurement of purchasing power would have to rely upon the prices of the goods and services of the first order, and what is more, all of them. To employ the prices of the producer goods is not helpful, because it could not avoid counting the various stages of production of one and the same consumer's goods several times, and thus falsifying the result. A restriction to a group of selected goods would be quite arbitrary and therefore vicious. But even apart from all these insurmountable obstacles, the task would remain insoluble, for not only do the technological features of commodities change, and new kinds of goods appear while many old ones disappear, valuations change too, and they cause changes in demand and production. The assumptions of the measurement doctrine would require men whose wants and valuations are rigid. Only if people were to value the same things always in the same way could we consider price changes as expressive of changes in the power of money to buy things. As it is impossible to establish the total amount of money spent at a given fraction of time for consumers' goods, statisticians must rely upon the prices paid for individual commodities. This raises two further problems for which there is no apodictic solution. It becomes necessary to attach to the various commodities coefficients of importance. It would be manifestly wrong to let the prices of various commodities enter into the computation without taking into account the different roles they play in the total system of individuals' households. But the establishment of such proper weighting is again arbitrary. Secondly, it becomes necessary to compute averages out of the data collected and adjusted, but there exists, or but there exist, different methods for the computation of averages. There are the arithmetic, the geometric, the harmonic averages, there is the quasi-average known as the median. Each of them leads to different results, and none of them can be recognized as a unique way to attain a logically unassailable answer. The decision in favor of one of these methods of computation is arbitrary. If all human conditions were unchangeable, if all people were always to repeat the same actions because their uneasiness and their ideas about its removal were constant, or if we were in a position to assume that changes in these factors occurring with some individuals or groups are always outweighed by opposite changes with other individuals or groups and therefore do not affect total demand and total supply, we would live in a world of stability. But the idea that in such a world money's purchasing power could change is contradictory. As will be shown later, changes in the purchasing power of money must necessarily affect the prices of different commodities and services at different times and to different extents. They must consequently bring about changes in demand and supply, in production and consumption. The idea implied in the inappropriate term level of prices, as if other things being equal, all prices could rise or drop evenly, is untenable. Other things cannot remain equal if the purchasing power of money changes. In the field of praxeology and economics, no sense can be given to the notion of measurement. In the hypothetical state of rigid conditions, there are no changes to be measured. In the actual world of changes, there are no fixed points, dimensions, or relations which could serve as a standard. The monetary unit's purchasing power never changes evenly with regard to all things vendable and purchasable. The notions of stability and stabilization are empty if they do not refer to a state of rigidity and its preservation. However, this state of consequence is still less can, or sorry, however, this state of rigidity cannot even be thought out consistently to its logical or its ultimate logical consequences, still less can it be realized. Where there is action, there is change. Action is a lever of change. The pretentious solemnity which statisticians and statistical bureaus display in computing indexes of purchasing power and the cost of living is out of place. These index numbers are at best rather crude and inaccurate illustrations of changes which have occurred in periods of slow alterations in the relation between the supply of and the demand for money. They do not convey any information at all. Oh God, this is horrible. I've got some bubble of something floating about in one of my inner ears, and all I can hear is my own voice. Oh, now I know how everyone else feels listening to this stuff. In periods of inflation and consequently of sharp price changes, they provide a rough image of events which every individual experiences in his daily life. A judicious housewife knows much more about price changes as far as they affect her own household than the statistical averages can tell. She has little use for computations disregarding changes both in quality and in the amount of goods which she is able to buy or permitted to buy at the prices entering into the computation. If she measures the changes for her personal appreciation by taking the prices of only two or three commodities a yardstick, she is no less scientific and no more arbitrary than the sophisticated mathematicians in choosing their methods for the manipulation of the data in the market. Got to give that a refresh because I saw a thing on my phone there. Thank you very much, Martin Hudson, for the £21 given towards the fund. Oh, your contribution, as with everyone else's, is greatly appreciated. In practical life, nobody lets himself be fooled by index numbers. Nobody agrees with the fiction that they are to be considered as measurements. Where quantities are measured, all further doubts and disagreements concerning their dimensions cease. These questions are settled. Nobody ventures to argue with the meteorologists about their measurement of temperature, humidity, atmospheric pressure, and other meteorological data. But on the other hand, nobody acquiesces in an index number if he does not expect a personal advantage from its acknowledgement by public opinion. The establishment of index numbers does not settle disputes, it merely shifts them into a field in which a clash of antagonistic opinions and interests is irreconcilable. Human action originates change. As far as there is human action, there is no stability, but ceaseless alteration. The historical process is a sequence of changes. It is beyond the power of man to stop and bring about an age of stability in which all history comes to a standstill. It is man's nature to strive after improvement, to beget new ideas, and to rearrange the conditions of his life according to those ideas. The prices of the market are historical facts, expressive of a state of affairs that prevailed at a definite instant of the irreversible historical process. In the praxeological orbit, the concept of measurement does not make any sense. In the imaginary and, of course, unrealizable state of rigidity and stability, there are no changes to be measured. In the actual world of permanent change, there are no fixed points, objects, qualities, or relations with regard to which changes could be measured. Number 5, the root of the stabilization idea. Economic calculation does not require monetary stability in the sense which this term is used by the champions of the stabilization movement. The fact that rigidity in the monetary unit purchasing power is unthinkable and unrealizable does not impair the methods of economic calculation. What economic calculation requires is a monetary system whose functioning is not sabotaged by government interference. The endeavours to expand the quantity of money in circulation either in order to increase the government's capacity to spend or in order to bring about a temporary lowering of the rate of interest disintegrate all currency matters and derange economic calculation. The first aim of monetary policy must be to prevent governments from embarking upon inflation and from creating conditions which produce credit expansion on the part of the banks. This program is very different from the confused and self-contradictory program of stabilizing purchasing power. For the sake of economic calculation, all that is needed is to avoid great and abrupt fluctuations in the supply of money. Gold and, up to the middle of the 19th century, silver served very well all the purposes of economic calculation. Changes in the relation between the supply of and the demand of the precious metals and the resulting alterations in purchasing power went on so slowly that the entrepreneur's economic calculation. God, sorry, I've lost where I was there. Changes in the relation between the supply of and the demand for the precious metals and the resulting alterations in purchasing power went on so slowly that the entrepreneur's economic calculation could disregard them without going too far afield. Precision is unattainable in economic calculation, quite apart from the shortcomings emanating from the not paying due consideration to monetary changes. The planning businessman cannot help employing data concerning the unknown future. He deals with future prices and future costs of production. Accounting and bookkeeping in their endeavours to establish the result of past action are in the same position as far as they rely upon the estimation of fixed equipment, inventories, and receivables. In spite of all of these uncertainties, economic calculation can achieve its tasks. For these uncertainties do not stem from deficiencies of the system of calculation. They are inherent in the essence of acting that always deal with the uncertain future. The idea of rendering purchasing power stable did not originate from endeavours to make economic calculation more correct. Its source is the wish to create a sphere withdrawn from the ceaseless flux of human affairs, a realm which the historical process does not affect. Endowments which were designed to provide perpetuity for an ecclesiastic body, for a charitable institution, or for a family were long established in land or disbursement of agricultural products in kind. Later annuities to be settled on money were added. Endowers and beneficiaries expected that an annuity determined in terms of a definite amount of precious metals would not be affected by changes in economic conditions. But these hopes were illusory. Later generations learned that the plans of their ancestors were not realised. Stimulated by this experience, they began to investigate how the aims sought could be attained. Thus, they embarked upon attempts to measure changes in purchasing power and to eliminate such changes. The problem assumed much greater importance when governments initiated their policies of long-term, irredeemable and perpetual loans. The state, this new deity of the dawning age of statolatry, this eternal and superhuman institution beyond the reach of earthly frailties, offered to the citizen an opportunity to put his wealth in safety and to enjoy a stable income secure against all vicissitudes. It opened a way to free the individual from the necessity of risking and acquiring his wealth and his income anew each day in the capitalist market. He who invested his funds in bonds issued by the government and its subdivisions was no longer subject to the inescapable laws of the market and to the sovereignty of the consumers. He was no longer under the necessity of investing his funds. Oh God, my head's ripping. This thing will not go away. Oh. He was no longer under the necessity of investing his funds in such a way that they would best serve the wants and needs of the consumers. He was secure. He was safeguarded against the dangers of the competitive market in which losses are the penalty of inefficiency. The eternal state had taken him under its wing and guaranteed him the undisturbed enjoyment of his funds. Henceforth, his income no longer stemmed from the process of supplying the wants of the consumers in the best possible way, but from the taxes levied by the state's apparatus of compulsion and coercion. He was no longer a servant of his fellow citizens, subject to their sovereignty. He was a partner of the government which ruled the people in exacted tribute from them. What the government paid as interest was less than the market offered, but this difference was far outweighed by the unquestionable solvency of the debtor, the state whose revenue did not depend on satisfying the public, but insisting on the payment of taxes. In spite of the unpleasant experiences with public debts in earlier days, people were ready to trust freely the modernised state of the 19th century. It was generally assumed that this new state would scrupulously meet its voluntary contracted obligations. Capitalists and entrepreneurs were fully aware of the fact that in the market society there is no means of preserving acquired wealth other than by acquiring it anew each day in tough competition with everybody, with the already existing firms as well as with newcomers operating on a shoestring. The entrepreneur, grown old and weary and no longer prepared to risk his hard-earned wealth by attempts to meet the wants of consumers and the heir of other people's profits, lazy and fully conscious of his own inefficiency, preferred investment in bonds of the public debt because they wanted to be free from the law of the market. Now, the irredeemable perpetual public debt presupposes the stability of purchasing power. Although the state and its compulsion may be eternal, the interest paid in the public's debt could be eternal only if based on a standard of unchanging value. In this form, the investor who, for security's sake, shuns the market, entrepreneurship and investment in free enterprise and prefers government bonds is faced again with the problem of the changeability of all human affairs. He discovers that in the frame of a market society there is no room left for the wealth not dependent upon the market. His endeavours to find an inexhaustible source of income fail. There are in this world no such things as stability and security, and no human endeavours are powerful enough to bring them about. There is, in the social system of the market society, no other means of acquiring wealth and of preserving it than successful service to the consumers. The state is, of course, in a position to exact payments from its subjects and to borrow funds. However, even the most ruthless government in the long run is not able to defy the laws determining human life and action. If the government uses the sums borrowed for investment in those lines which they best serve the wants of the consumers, and if it succeeds in these entrepreneurial activities in free and equal competition with all private entrepreneurs, it is the same position as any other businessman. It can pay interest because it has made surpluses. If the government invests funds unsuccessfully and no surplus results, or if it spends the money for the current expenditure, the capital borrowed shrinks or disappears entirely, and no source is open from which interest and principal could be paid. Then, taxing the people is the only method available for complying with the articles of the credit contract. In asking taxes for such payments, the government makes the citizen answerable for the money squandered in the past. The taxes paid are not compensated by any present service rendered by the government apparatus. The government pays interest on capital which has been consumed and no longer exists. The treasury is burdened with the unfortunate results of past policies. A good case can be made for short-term government debts under special conditions. Of course, the popular justification of war loans is nonsensical. All the materials needed for the conduct of a war must be provided by restriction of civilian consumption, by using up a part of the capital available, and by working harder. The whole burden of warring falls upon the living generation. The coming generations are only affected to the extent which, on account of the war expenditure, they will inherit loss from now living, or from now those. The coming generations are only affected to the extent to which, on account of the war expenditure, they will inherit less from those now living than they would have if no war had been fought. Financing a war through loans does not shift the burden to the sons and grandsons. It is merely a method of distributing the burden among the citizens. If the whole expenditure had to be provided by taxes, only those who have liquid funds could be approached. The rest of the people would not contribute adequately. Short-term loans could be instrumental in removing such inequalities as they offer for a fair assessment on the owners of the fixed capital. Oh. God, this is really starting to annoy me now. Oh. The long-term public and semi-public credit is a foreign and disturbing element in the structure of a market society. Its establishment was a futile attempt to go beyond the limits of human action and to create an orbit of security and eternity removed from the transitoriness and stability or instability of earthly affairs. What an arrogant presumption to borrow and to lend money forever and ever, to make contracts for eternity, to stipulate for all times to come. In this respect, it mattered little whether the loans were in a formal manner made irredeemable or not. Intentionally and practically, they were, as a rule, considered and dealt with as such. In the heyday of liberalism, some Western nations really retired parts of their long-term debt by honest reimbursement. But for the most part, new debts were only heaped upon old ones. The financial history of the last century shows a steady increase in the amount of public indebtedness. And nobody believes that the states will eternally drag the burden of those interest payments. It's obvious that sooner or later all these debts will be liquidated in some way or other, but certainly not by payment of interest and principal according to the terms of the contract. A host of sophisticated writers are already busy elaborating the palliation for the final day of final settlement. The fact that economic calculation in terms of money is unequal to the tasks which are assigned to it in these illusory schemes for establishment of an unrealizable realm of calm removed from the inescapable limitations of human action and providing eternal security cannot be called a deficiency. There are no such things as eternal, absolute, and unchanging values. The search for a standard of such values is vain. Economic calculation is not imperfect because it does not correspond to the confused ideas of people yearning for a stable income,
not dependent on the productive process then.
Oh. Section 13. Monetary calculation as a tool of action. Number 1. Monetary calculation as a method of thinking. Monetary calculation is the guiding star of action under the social system of division of labour. It is the compass of man embarking upon production. He calculates in order to distinguish the remunerative lines of production from the unprofitable ones, those of which the sovereign consumers are likely to approve those... God, I'm just all over the place today. He calculates in order to distinguish the remunerative lines of production from the unprofitable ones, those of which the sovereign consumers are likely to approve from those of which they are likely to disapprove. Every single step of entrepreneurial activities is subject to scrutiny by monetary calculation. The premeditation of planned action becomes commercial precalculation of expected costs and expected outputs, expected proceeds. The retrospective establishment of the outcome of past action becomes an accounting of profit and loss. The system of economic calculation in monetary terms is conditioned by certain social institutions. It can operate only in an institutional setting of the division of labour and the private ownership of the means of production in which goods and services of all orders are bought and sold against a generally used medium of exchange, i.e. money. Monetary calculation is the method of calculating employed by the people acting within the frame of society based on private control of the means of production. It is a device of acting individuals. It is a mode of computation designed for ascertaining private wealth and income, private losses, private profits and losses of individuals acting on their own behalf within a free enterprise society. All its results refer to the actions of individuals only. When statisticians summarise these results, the outcome shows the sum of the autonomous actions of a plurality of self-directing individuals, but not the effect of the action of a collective body, of a whole, or of a totality. Monetary calculation is entirely inapplicable for useless for any... Monetary calculation is entirely inapplicable and useless for any consideration which does not look at things from the point of view of individuals. It involves calculating the individual's profits, not imaginary social values and social welfare. Monetary calculation is the main vehicle of planning and acting in the social setting of a society of free enterprise directed and controlled by the market and its prices. It is developed in this frame and was gradually perfected with the improvement of the market mechanism and with the expansion of the scope of things which are negotiated on markets against money. It was economic calculation that assigned to measurement, number and reckoning the role they play in our quantitative and computing civilization. The measurements of physics and chemistry make sense for practical action only. There is economic calculation. I'm really sorry about this. I'm just not with it today at all. And this thing going on in my ear is really ticking me off. It was economic calculation that assigned to measurement, number and reckoning the role they play in our quantitative and computing civilization. The measurements of physics and chemistry make sense for practical action only because there is economic calculation. It is monetary calculation that made arithmetic a tool in the struggle for a better life. It provides a mode of using these achievements of laboratory experiments for the most efficacious removal of uneasiness. Monetary calculation reaches its full perfection in capital accounting. It establishes the money prices of the available means and confronts this total with the changes brought about by action and by the operation of other factors. This confrontation shows what changes occurred in the state of the acting men's affairs and the magnitude of those changes. It makes success and failure, profit and loss ascertainment. God, I just can't read today. This is terrible. Oh. This confrontation shows what changes occurred in the state of acting man's me act. Bruh. Ugh. This confrontation shows what changes occurred in the state of the acting men's affairs and the magnitude of those changes. It makes success and failure, profit and loss ascertainable. The system of free enterprise has been dubbed capitalism in order to depreciate and to smear it. However, this term can be considered very pertinent. It refers to the most characteristic feature of the system. Pardon me. Oh. Its main eminence vis-a-vis the role the notion of capital plays in its conduct. There are people to whom monetary calculation is repulsive. They do not want to be roused from their daydreams by the voice of critical reason. Reality sickens them. They long for a realm of unlimited opportunity. They are disgusted by the meanness of a social order in which everything is nicely reckoned in dollars and pennies. God, I even think I'm missing lines and stuff and all sorts here. There are people to whom monetary calculation is repulsive. They do not want to be roused from their daydreams by the voice of critical reason. Reality sickens them. They long for a realm of unlimited opportunity. They are disgusted by the meanness of a social order in which everything is nicely reckoned in dollars and pennies. They call their grumbling the noble deportment worthy of the friends of the spirit of beauty and virtue as opposed to the ignoble baseness and villainy of babbitry. However, the cult of beauty and virtue, wisdom and the search for truth are not hindered by the rationality of the calculating and computing mind. It is only a romantic revere that cannot thrive in a milieu of sober criticism. The cool-headed reckoner is the stern chastiser of the ecstatic visionary. Our civilization is inseparably linked with our methods of economic calculation. It would perish if we were to abandon this most... It would perish if we were to abandon this most precious intellectual tool of acting. Goethe was right in calling bookkeeping by double entry one of the finest inventions of the human mind. Ugh. Ugh. Number 2, economic calculation and the science of human action. The evolution of capitalist economic calculation was a necessary condition for the establishment of a systemic and logically coherent science of human action. Praxeology and economics have a definite place in the evolution of human history and in the process of scientific research. They could only emerge when acting men had succeeded in creating methods of thinking that made it possible to calculate his actions. The science of human action was, at beginning, merely a discipline dealing with those actions which can be tested by monetary calculation. It dealt exclusively with what we may call the orbit of economics in a narrower sense, that is, with those actions which within a market society are transacted by the intermediary of money. The first steps on the way to its elaboration were odd investigations concerning currency, money lending, and the prices of various goods. The knowledge conveyed by Gresham's law, the first crude formulations of the quantity theory of money, such as those of Bowden and Davazanti, and the law of Gregory King, marked the first dawn of the cognition that the regularity of phenomena and inevitable necessity prevail in the field of action. The first comprehensive system of economic theory, that brilliant achievement of the classical economists, was essentially a theory of calculated action. It drew implicitly that borderline between what is to be considered economic and what extra-economic along the line which separates action calculated in monetary terms from other action. Starting from the basis that economists were bound to widen the step by step the field of the studies until they finally developed a system dealing with all human choices, a general theory of action. Oh. Part 4, Catalactics or Economics of the Market Society, Section 14, The Scope and Methods of Catalactics, and number 1, The Delimination of Catalactic Problems. There have never been any doubts and uncertainties about the scope of economic science. Ever since people have been eager for a systematic study of economics or political economy, all have agreed that it is the task of this branch of knowledge to investigate the market phenomena. That is, the determination of the mutual exchange ratios of the goods and services negotiated on markets, their origin in human action and their effects upon later action. The intricacy of a precise definition of the scope of economics does not stem from uncertainty with regard to the orbit of the phenomena to be investigated. It is due to the fact that the attempts to elucidate the phenomena concerned must go beyond the range of the maker and of the market transactions. In order to conceive the market fully, one is forced to study the action of hypothetical isolated individuals on one hand and the contrasting market system with an imaginary socialist commonwealth on the other hand. But studying intrapersonal exchange, one cannot avoid dealing with autistic exchange. But then it is no longer possible to define neatly the boundaries between the kind of action which is proper field of economic science in a narrower sense and other action. Economics widens its horizon and turns into a general science of all and every human action into praxeology. The question emerges of how to distinguish precisely within the broader field of general praxeology a narrower orbit of specifically economic problems. The abortive attempts to solve this problem of a precise delimitation of the scope of catalactics have chosen as a criterion either the motives causing action or the goals which action aims at. But the variety and manifoldness of the motives instigating a man's actions is without relevance for a comprehensive study of acting. I just wish I could get rid of this pocket or whatever it is in my ear. It's really starting to hurt my head now. The abortive attempts to solve this problem of a precise delimitation of the scope of catalactics is chosen as a criterion either the motives causing action or the goals which action aims at. I'm really sorry. I think I'm gonna have to call this early today because my head's gone to pot and the inside of my head is echoing in the most horrible fashion, and I don't really know how to deal with that. And I would rather not continue on and have it just get worse. Also can't hear my own voice properly, which is I think half the reason why I can't read properly. I'm really sorry about that. I'm just gonna have to kind of cut this off early. The fund will still be there, as I said, for probably at least another week or so. So if anyone wants to help, the link can be found there. I'll probably post it back again in the Telegram channel and stuff. I'm really sorry. I'm gonna have to bounce off. I don't know if I'll pick this back up or not. I really had other plans and things to do with my time, and didn't want this to carry on past 2 weeks. So. Yeah, apologies for that. I'm gonna bounce off now. Sorry.